You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter in a wet, drippy spring Davis day. You know, it's nice out. It's just very damp.
It's a change for us in the valley here. We haven't seen this kind of weather in 5 or 6 weeks. We actually got some rain overnight. I thought we were going to get through the month of March without any rainfall, because so far until March 30th, even the morning of March 31st, we had not had any measurable rainfall in the month of March here, at least at the Davis Weather Station. But this storm came in as expected, and we got an entire 1/10 of an inch of rain overnight at the Davis Station, and about that much at nearby weather stations. So we got a little bit of rain. It is overcast as we are preparing the show on April 1st, 2026, for broadcast on April 2nd. It has been raining a little bit overnight. They're telling us that showers are likely today, with a high today of 63 degrees.
Wait a minute. That was our low a couple weeks ago.
Well, it was, actually, yes. So, in fact, as recently as a week ago, we were hitting 88, 89, 90 degrees, and now we're going to be 63 degrees, which, just for the record, let's head on over to weatherspark.com. And
it's see. Usually around 70 now, isn't it? This year,
very good. Exactly. Yes. April 1 average high temperature is 70. Average low temperature April 1 is 46. And we're going to be, let's see, low temperature tonight will be 43. So a little below average. And we've been running way above average on nighttime temperatures. So let's go through these temperatures for the next few days. The rain will devolve to a chance of rain tonight, low of 43 degrees, tonight being Wednesday, day of the broadcast, a high of 65 degrees, but sunny. So kind of cold air coming in behind this storm, but clear and sunny on Thursday. Thursday night, clear, 46 degrees. Friday, sunny, 74 degrees. Okay, warming back up. And Friday night, clear, 47 degrees. Saturday, 79 degrees and sunny. That will be a low Saturday night of 49. Sunday, Easter Sunday, will be 83 degrees and sunny. And Sunday night will be 51 degrees. And Monday will be sunny with a high near 80. And Monday night will be 49 degrees. So substantially cooler than it has been for the last several weeks here in the Sacramento Valley. Night temperatures dropping back down into the 40s. We'll see what that does to soil temperature. Obviously, April is here. Everybody's jumping in, planting, buying plants, talking about summer vegetables, all that kind of thing. The weather is a little bit colder than we like for the summer vegetables, as we, of course, mentioned repeatedly here. But a lot of people got them in early. A lot of people have raised planters. The soil temperature, someone told me he recorded a soil temperature of 70 degrees in his raised planter bed. All right, well, your vegetables are off to a good start. We'll just see how things go over the next week. A reminder that we, for best results, recommend planting tomatoes in April. Hey, we're there. Peppers and eggplant in May. But it's a weird year, so do whatever you want. How's that? We've got...
You know, Don, you can say that almost every year.
It's been a weird year, yes. Well, this year, what we've had that's memorable was the extraordinary cold fog that we had in November. 2 weeks of very cold, dreary weather, briefly broken up, and then 3 weeks straight where it was literally 41 to 45 degrees was the entire temperature range for 22 days in November and early December. Pretty cold on into the rest of December, to the point that we had basically received most of the chilling hours that fruit trees and other temperate zone deciduous plants required by mid to late December. And we ended the year with, I think it was 1,200 chilling hours. We've had plenty as far as that goes. And then we were doing okay for rainfall. And then February, we had a rainstorm, and that was it. And for 5 or 6 weeks straight, basically no rain, basically no clouds or fog. So delightful from a gardening standpoint, but a little disconcerting with respect to soil moisture. So the only
And
thing I.
confusing to the plants, because if you were putting them in like they were May, but it really is March, and now it's cooler. Well, poor little
We've
things.
actually had people saying things that we usually hear in May, things like, oh, I guess the planting window is closing. There's people who have a very narrow range of landscaping and planting. There's a temperature range that really is optimal for plants, 55 to 85 degrees. I learned this years ago, and I've also joked many times, it's also optimal for gardeners. It really doesn't matter from the plant standpoint as much as it does from the people standpoint. 88, 90 degrees, oh, it's getting too hot. The planting window is closing. The whole month of April is a very active planting time. So I would suggest that we go more by averages, perhaps than extremes, when we're deciding what that window is. More to the point, you can plant anytime as long as you give proper aftercare. The key right now, and my big concern is, despite this tenth of an inch of rain that we've had, the top several inches to foot of soil is quite dry. We have not had significant rainfall since, as I say, early February. And when I'm going out to plant things, I'm planting trees and a lot of other things, and I'm getting the vegetable garden area ready. The soil is dry in the root zone of those new seedlings you would be planting. I would suggest, just like last year, and actually last year, we even had more rain going into the beginning of the season, but we did have a dry March for the start of the season last year. You should really hydrate the whole bed really thoroughly. Don't just water the little plant you just planted. This is crucial because we had a lot of conversations with people last year as we got into June and July where plants were just struggling, clearly not growing well, and it typically devolved down to inadequate soil moisture and inadequate nitrogen. We've talked about ways to provide nitrogen, manure, whatever you want to do, but the key thing here is that the top soil zone that you're planting into is dry. If you use a drip system and you only run it for 30, 45 minutes, you've probably watered that little nursery plant you just bought, but not much below that or not much beyond that. And roots cannot grow into dry soil. So hydrate the whole bed really thoroughly. And then wait a couple of days so it's not quite so muddy. Go ahead and plant and then begin your regular irrigation. We'll certainly talk about summer vegetable and summer flower irrigation more as the season warms back up. But the key thing this year, just as with last year, a really thorough soaking beforehand would be great. And here's an interesting point. It's good to water when it's raining. I know that your city says don't. Municipal water districts will always tell you, turn off your sprinklers when it's raining. I've had people say, oh, look, I was driving and it was raining and the city sprinklers were running. They should turn them off. Aside from the complete impracticality of trying to implement that at a municipal level, it actually doesn't hurt to water when it's raining. And you're not wasting water. And I would remind everyone that when we irrigate, we're generally banking several days' worth of water for the plants. We're watering them for the whole week ahead, or at least 3 to 4 days ahead. If you're expecting an inch to an inch and a half of rain, sure, turn off your sprinklers. The ET rate is very, very low. It's practically zero right now because of how humid it is and the fact that it's raining and it's overcast. But unless you expect that rainstorm to bring you a full 3 to 7 days worth of water, there's nothing at all wrong with watering while it's raining. And the capillary action will be improved because rainfall is more evenly distributed than sprinkler irrigation. So it's fine to water when it's raining, especially with drip systems. It simply enhances the performance of your irrigation cycle. The city doesn't want you doing it, so don't do it on your lawn sprinklers in a visible manner, but there's nothing at all wrong with running a good long soaker hose drip system kind of thing. When rain is actually coming down. Obviously, if we're getting 3 inches of rain, you don't need to irrigate. You could turn off your system and wait a week and pick up again, but there is nothing wrong with irrigating when there's light, showery rainfall activity. End rant. We got some announcements, right, Lois?
I have a new saying for the garden show. Soil sucks. Make sure that you've watered it before you plant, because a dry soil will just suck the moisture out of whatever's next to it.
In an average year, we get 3 inches of rain in March, and we didn't get any rain except tenth of an inch on the last day. So 3 inches of rain should penetrate to a foot or so and spread out. And my main point is that if you start the season dry, a lot of the soil around that little plant is dry, especially, by the way, in raised planters because they drain out and they dry out faster. Again, you'll have to water your raised planter, whether it's flowers or vegetables or whatever, more frequently than you would have to water the same plants if they were out in the open ground. Raised planters have a lot of advantages, but one of the drawbacks is that they tend not to hold moisture. And that is largely a function of the type of soil you put into them, coupled with gravity. So again, reminder from previous shows, top dress your gardens, put in some kind of compost, mulch around the plants. Straw is my favorite mulch personally. One, I can create a lot of it here just by mowing. Two, it makes a great shade for the surface and it breaks down and improves the soil. But whatever is convenient, locally available to you, mulching your garden at the time of planting and giving everything a really thorough soaking at the time of planting or shortly beforehand will make a big difference in your success this year. Okay, announcements.
Announcements. Okay, so I've got my April 4th, which is coming up real quick, like it's this Saturday, and the following week, April 11th. Both of those days, the Tree Davis is having an open space event where you can go out and volunteer to help mulch, weed, prune native trees, create pipevine habitat, remove mistletoe. And so if you want to be part of that event, where do they go, Don? How do they find out?
Go to treedavis.org, look on the events, the open space tree stewardship event even gives you the coordinates there. You can park nearby. If you're in South Davis, you'll know the area down near Poudre Creek, the south edge of town.
Well, I have another thing you can do on April 11th. Actually, it's the 11th and 12th, and this is the Bonsai Show.
Oh,
The
wow.
Sacramento Garden and Art Center is hosting the Bonsai Spring Show and from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. The event is free,
We got a note
and the
from.
Sacramento Garden and Art Center is at 3330 McKinley Boulevard in Sacramento.
Got a note from one of our producers here, Rocky Outcrop, who has a great program coming up. Rocky does a show called Yolo County Breakdown, and that is on, let's see here, Fridays, 10 to 11 a.m. Rocky just finished interviewing Jim Lauderdale. Their chat
Ooh.
will feature on the April 10th installment of the Yolo County Breakdown. Jim is a two-time Grammy winner, mainstay of bluegrass and Americana music. He has written songs for George Strait, Elvis Costello, Vince Gill, lots more. He's embarking on a tour of Europe shortly with Emmylou Harris. We chat about, he says, many of his projects, including collaborations with Ralph Stanley, Roland White, the Grateful Dead lyricist Robert Hunter. His next album, The Bird Knows, is coming out April 24. Rocky says he gave me permission to play tracks from the album before it is released, a KDRT World premiere. So, Rocky Outcrop with the Yolo County Breakdown, that is on Fridays, 10 to 11 a.m., replays on Sundays, 3 to 4 p.m., right here at KDRT. Just a quick note, I promised Ashdale that I would answer a question for him for his mother. He wanted to know some tomato suggestions, and his mom primarily slices them for sandwiches or cuts them in wedges for salad, which is really a particular kind of tomato. You want a firmer textured tomato that holds together better. You don't want one that's all saucy or sloppy, so you'd be looking for a firmer textured type. And also, they only have room for two, so we want something that'll hopefully give fruit over a very long period. Immediately, I thought of Champion, simply because every year Champion produces very well for me, goes well into the fall season. Great performance, great flavor, a little on the tart side. That was a comment made by one of my customers, and I agree with it. It's a little more on the acidic side, but it is a very good flavor and probably very good for those purposes. And I have had experience with Champion continuing all the way into November and even the first week of December. It's got a little bit tougher skin, and so that means it holds up well as we get into the adverse weather. Other one I thought of was Ace, which is actually a smaller plant. It's determinate. It really is the classic for what's being described here, a slicing tomato, a salad tomato. Ace only goes to about 4 feet, produces 15 or 20 fruit, but sort of steadily over the course of the season, probably done by September, early October. Very good quality, sometimes described as low acid. I think it's just sweeter, and it has a very pleasant flavor and a good texture for the purposes that are being described here. So Ace would be a smaller plant, wouldn't be as many fruit, obviously, but be a good possibility for this as well. And then it occurred to me that there's a whole series called Chef's Choice, and that really is exactly what they had in mind with the first ones they introduced, slicing and wedging tomatoes, if you will. Chef's Choice Orange is the best of the batch. It's a very vigorous plant. Mine have at times produced 40, 50 fruit or more, and all of them hitting 3/4 of a pound or even bigger. The Chef's Choice Orange is beautiful, firm textured, great flavor on that one, so it would really fit the purposes here. But if you don't happen to want an orange tomato, and I understand that, there's a red and a pink, and my experience with them was they're also very vigorous, very productive. softened a little faster than a chef's choice orange, but would probably be very good for these purposes. I still think the chef's choice orange is one of the best. Then I happen to mention this to my friend Fred Hoffman, Farmer Fred, who I do occasionally visit on his podcast. And he thought of New Girl, and I agree, New Girl, it's the sort of an improvement on Early Girl. Big enough fruit, 6 to 8 ounce fruit, good red, good production, firm texture enough for the purposes described here. And I've compared it, as he has, against Early Girl for a couple years now. It seems to have settled a little further into high temperatures compared to Early Girl, and does give a good crop at the end of the season as well. Both of them, Early Girl, New Girl, tend to stop in the very middle of the season, but New Girl just was marginally better than Early Girl in that regard. I should mention that I was chatting with him because I then went and sat in on his podcast, Beyond the Garden Basics, and we brought this topic up there. So there's more discussion over there with some other suggestions that should be airing sometime in a few days. So head over to gardenbasics.substack.com for more in our annual discussion of the upcoming tomato season. All right, I sent you a picture, as I
Oh,
usually
no,
do.
a picture, Don. He labeled it too. He called
Very good. Macfadyina. This ties into one of the questions we got. We can do this one pretty quickly and then we'll get to your more formal questions. What is this a picture of?
Well, you know, when I first saw it, I thought somebody had taken super glue to the stamens and just glued them down to the bottom of the plant because it just looks so weird. But it looks like a vine. It has little thing, viney things. It's bright yellow. I mean, like canary yellow.
That's a good description. Yes, that's. I've been trying to figure out butter yellow is the phrase I'd been using.
No,
but
that's
no, this is,
too pale.
Yeah,
no, this is canary yellow.
Color of a canary. Got it.
So I had no clue what it is, but Don said, look at this little thing. He pointed out at the end of one of these viney bits, there's a three-pronged, short. It looks like it's a grabber of some sort.
It's a tendril. Yes. Technically it's a tendril. Yes.
So his says that means that this is a cat's claw.
Yes.
Yellow flower.
So if you take your finger and pull it along that tendril, it will grab at your finger. It has a little recurved end to the tendril that actually clings to things. This vine, rather, many tendril vines, like grapes are a good example of a tendril climbing vine. The tendril will reach out and will wrap around something. It will hold the vine up by wrapping itself around a nearby structure. This one will actually just cling on to it. Klingon. There we go. That we should have given this a whole new name. I can see some great marketing potential for this plant. And it is even used in Arizona and places like that, very high temperature areas, to cling to brick or stucco surfaces. As long as there's a slight texture to the surface, it actually can hold on, but it doesn't root in and it doesn't wrap around. So this is Macfadyina unguiscati, one of my favorite plant names because it's so hard to say and spell.
I want you to do that three times fast, Don.
Macfadyina unguiscati, Macfadyina unguiscati, Macfadyina unguiscati. Way back when trumpet vines were first given their names, they were all thought to be in the same genus, Bignonia, which is the family, Bignoniaceae, of pretty much all the trumpet vines, as well as a number of trees. Catalpa is in the Bignoniaceae. They all have a somewhat flattened trumpet flower. So Lois describing it looking like something had been done to it. The flower is not a tube, a solid tube. It's a flattened tube. They're very, very attractive in general in this whole family, Bignoniaceae, trumpet vine family, to hummingbirds, which is the structure of the flower. I haven't, by the way, noticed them heavily visiting this particular plant in the trumpet vine family, but all the members of trumpet vine were in the genus Bignonia. This was Bignonia tweediana. There was Bignonia violacea, all these other ones. 50 plus years ago, taxonomists realized this was perhaps a case of convergent evolution, not a case of close relationships. They were not all that closely related. They just had similar flower structure. So the decision was made. All the fights in taxonomy are between lumpers and splitters. Lumpers want to group them all together. Splitters want to split them up. Well, in this case, the splitters won, and all the Bignonia, with one exception, were given new generic names, new names of the genus, and therefore the species was often changed as well. So Bignonia tweediana was named after a gentleman named Macfaddy. So it was named Macfadyina. Unguis means claw. Catty means cat. So this is Macfaddy's cat's claw, Or you can also just call it yellow trumpet vine. The reason I post this is that there's a fence at our nursery that is covered with this plant, and it is in full bloom right now, as it will be for about 2 weeks. It'll be solid yellow. Once upon a time, the entire fence across the street from us along the PG&E Corporation yard, hundreds and hundreds of yards of fence, were also covered with this plant. A year or so ago, they took it all out. They completely redid that fence, and I was rather surprised they've managed to keep it out. So if you want this plant, I want to immediately throw on one caveat. It's invasive. It will cover anything, like many trumpet vines will. It also will reseed, and it sets these long bean pods that are characteristic of the family, same kind you see on catalpa trees and other members of Bignoniaceae, and they can reseed a bit too. This particular plant, which covers about 40 feet of fence at our nursery, was a one-gallon pot that fell off the bench onto the ground behind the bench 30 plus years ago, rooted into the ground. We had an automatic spray system there, so it got watered automatically. So it rooted into the ground and flourished, and it now covers the entire fence from a plant that just happened to drop to the ground and root in. It's lovely. We like it. We pull the pods off before they split if we possibly can, because we don't want this spreading all over East Davis. But if you do decide you want this particular plant, be aware that it's very vigorous and potentially invasive. So you're not going to find it for sale at most nurseries. It came up in my conversation about this one with a customer, and then they said, well, what about other trumpet vines? As a group, many of them should be avoided entirely, but some of them are fine. So you need to do a little research before you just jump in and buy something labeled trumpet vine. It frustrates me, for example, that many nurseries just casually sell Campsis radicans, a trumpet creeper, to people as if it's going to be fine in their yard, when that thing suckers all over the place. I mean, 10, 15 feet away from where you planted it, root suckers are going to come up. So that one can become a real nightmare. By comparison, the lavender trumpet vine, Clytostoma calostegioides, used to be Bignonia violacea, Clytostoma calostegioides, is a very well-mannered vine that just tends to run up to the top of whatever it's on, gives you about a three-week bloom, just like this thing, this yellow one, and that's it. But the plant is evergreen, and it looks good most of the time. So it's a reasonable trumpet vine for this area. And there are other choices in that group that are called trumpet vine. It simply refers to the structure of the flower, and you can guess that almost anything called a trumpet vine or trumpet creeper is in Bignoniaceae. But wherever you're listening, there's one that grows, and wherever you're listening, there's probably one that's rather invasive. So do your homework before you just casually buy something labeled trumpet vine. The one we sell the most is the blood red trumpet vine. Phaedranthus buccinatoria, they really didn't, you know, give these easy names when they renamed them. Phaedranthus buccinatoria, also sold as Distichus buccinatoria, is a very, as I say, well-mannered, holds itself up by tendrils, but not by clinging. So normal tendrils that wrap around things. Bright, well, I should say dark red with a brighter orange throat, very showy flowers, extremely attractive to hummingbirds, and just cold hardy enough to grow here in zone 9 and quite vigorous. So if you're looking for a nice trumpet creeper or trumpet vine, something that will attract hummingbirds and is not a problem plant, go ahead and look for that one, the blood red trumpet vine. The regular trumpet creeper, we have some good examples around town. There used to be one on a telephone pole over on 3rd Street that had covered the entire pole. It's fine as long as you completely confine the roots. And so just sticking that in the ground in your yard, I've seen yards where that was done and it just becomes a nightmare. But it can be grown in a very large container or in an enclosed planter area without any problem. I just want people to be aware that one spreads vegetatively and can become quite a nuisance. So there are trumpet vines that are fine. There are trumpet vines that are not great to plant. So do a little homework before you buy one.
So that telephone pole vine, I wanted to have one, and so I was very careful to plant it in a plant in a pot. In fact, it was a half barrel, and so that I would not have it running all over my yard.
Yeah.
Well, that does not work at all. If you have a hole in the pot to let the water out, it's going to get its roots down there and run like crazy. So I've been trying to remove it for the last probably about 20 years.
Yeah.
And every time I see, it's got a very distinctive leaf. So once it comes out in the spring, in the summer, you can see it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but then you have to dig down and you have to, anyway, so be careful, listeners.
Campsis radicans is the group that I'm most concerned about. There is one of them, the Madame Galen, which is a little less vigorous than some of the others. But overall, there are better choices here. And if you're in Southern California, there are some subtropical trumpet vines that you can look at as well. Anyway, that's this week's picture, Macfadina unguis cati.
Well, we have another message from Emily, and she writes, "We recently moved here, and the Santa Rosa plum is starting to wake up and leaf out, not from the abruptly pruned branches, but right from the trunk. A lot of the leafing is occurring quite far down on the trunk. Should I allow the growth happening low in the trunk, or only allow growth in the top third or so, leave the branch stubs even if they produce no growth?" And the pictures that she sends is very interesting. Looks like someone came in and used a chainsaw. It's really ragged cuts. It topped it and then stubbed each of the side branches.
I don't
It's
know
a
why
very weird thing to have done
Well,
to
it was
this
excessively
tree.
pruned. I don't know why this is done. There might have been a reason, maybe some dieback or something. But what you've got here is what we in the business call panic growth. You've got some buds that are breaking further down on the plant. And we like to joke that they're trying to conserve the DNA before the tree dies. It is possible, given that there's several shoots visible on the trunk, including a couple up higher. There's one up 5 or 6 feet up, that this plant could restore itself. If it were mine, I never take a tree out because I've got room and I'd just like to see what happens. So I would probably leave it. But I would
And it's
probably,
early in the season. I
yeah,
mean,
exactly.
they're
But
very, very small growth things.
yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 points that I can see that's starting to grow, including pretty far up on this. But a lot of the places where it was cut are simply going to have to be cut back further to the main trunk. You're probably going to
But
have to
not
spend,
yet. Not yet. That's the key.
Yeah, let it go for now. Let it go grow into the summer. If these shoots do come out and they have enough energy to sustain the growth, you can probably look at that in June, July, and see what you're really working with. This kind of hard pruning, I don't want to call it non-professional, but it was non-professional. This was not something that was necessary as far as I can see on this, but it's possible that it will come back from this. It's going to be at least a year of growth before, or let's say one growing season of growth before you'll really know what you're working with. Sad to say, but.
So I see on the tree, it's down low. It's probably knee high or thigh high about there. And there's a bunch of leaves coming out directly, as she said, directly from the trunk, but they're very close together. In other words, I couldn't fit my hand between one and the next one. And that means if you let those grow out into actual branches, they're going to be way too close together. So
In
to
the long
my
run,
mind, I would go down there, I'd leave the lowest one there, and then I'd wipe out with my hand the next one up.
I would leave everything that's
Well,
growing on this poor plant that's trying to grow for now, and then I'd make that decision later. The question was, should she leave the lower ones? And that's what you were
yes.
answering. And I would say, yes, leave them for now. Yes, they're too close together. No, they're not going to be permanent branches, but they are photosynthesizing and they are encouraging the growth of the roots in the top. So for now, they stay. In the long run, you'll have to make some training decisions. And they are above the graft. So that's the other thing. It's a very good picture because it shows me that they are above the graft union. If they're coming up from below the graft union, well, then of course, those need to be taken off. I leave it all for now. See what happens. Cross your fingers, and I'll expect to see a picture in July.
Well, we are having so much problem with trees in today's show. This one is from Nina. I wrote to you last year about a horrible infestation of aphids we had in our green beans and lima beans, and you replied on your program last spring, much to my delight. The results of our changes are below among the photos, and this is a she sent photos of a structure.
Yeah, this is
I'm going to
simple.
say it's a chicken coop.
Well, it would make a good
Kind of
chicken
look,
coop if they lose
yeah.
interest in gardening. They
And
basically put the
with
plants
shade
in,
cloths, yeah.
put the plants in behind screen. And this
Yeah.
is standard technique for organic farmers. You can buy from places like Peaceful Valley Farm Supply, groworganic.com, I think is their web domain. Rolls and rolls and rolls of the kind of fabric that is used for frost protection, but it's also called seedling blanket. And one of its purposes in organic farming is they put hoops over the long beds. They just spread this, they do the planting, they immediately cover the hoops with this seedling blanket, which is a fine mesh material. And so the aphids who are flying in to oviposit can't get in there. And it's a really simple mechanical approach to keeping aphids off your plants. Beans can be really challenging because the black bean aphid, which is happily overwintered on many of your landscape shrubs and other plants in your yard will move on to beans as soon as you plant them. And it's a much tougher aphid to control, in my experience, than the peach aphid or the rose aphids, the softer bodied ones that you get. These are tougher customers. They got a heavier waxy coating on them, it seems. They don't blast off as readily, and they can build up to very large numbers very rapidly. And more to the point, ants will come along almost immediately and protect them. So that you immediately have on your lima beans and your regular beans this very unpleasantly spreading population of black bean aphid. I have sometimes just let them run their course to see what happens. Just does this one solve itself? Aphids on your roses usually solve themselves. Softer aphids are almost always eaten off by beneficials if you have a good population of beneficial insects. These guys do get parasitized. It's very important to know that parasitic wasps have overwintered with them on your shrubs and things nearby, so they do parasitize them. But because of the presence of the ants, their numbers can get serious enough to stunt the plants very badly. Twice I've done something, this is just anecdotal, folks. They started to get on young plants that were already climbing up a trellis, and they immediately got infested, and the ants were there protecting them. So I said, to heck with it, ripped out those plants, put them out with the compost or the trash, put them away from where we were, waited a week or two, replanted, and everything was fine. Now, I don't know why. Everything was fine on the second planting. Everything went well. I did not get aphids on the second planting. I did not get ants on the second planting. Apparently, just ripping that out, washing it all off, getting it all out of there, broke up that particular population being supported by that particular ant's nest. And that took care of it. The second planting went on fine. So I'm just passing that along as a possible option. Just rip them out and start over. I can think of hardly any simpler technique for dealing with aphids. And I'm not promising it's absolutely going to work, but the black bean aphid can be very, very challenging. This is a really simple way of dealing with it. They show up early. They multiply rapidly. Deal with the show up early part. Screen them out. That's exactly what they did here. This is great. So yet another one, as with a week or so ago, where we're talking about fencing in gardens for reasons, squirrels, deer. This is one where you're fencing them in, screening them out for aphids. You need a very fine mesh, but aphids aren't really bright. They're not trying to climb in or under something like a motivated tree squirrel might. They're just flying along, hovering. They're going down to try and land on a plant and oviposit. And if it's not convenient, they'll just go on to something else. So this is a very simple strategy. And I think I'm glad to see that this has worked for you. And as Lois alludes, if you get tired of gardening, you can turn this into a chicken coop. However,
so she's given us lots of information. One I found interesting said some of the lima beans seem to mutate to another similar looking but very tough version of lima bean. I think they're just old, Don.
That could be, or drought stress. If there happened to be drought stresses, they were at a particular stage getting close to harvest, then that could affect how tough or tender they are.
Okay. So now in the same email, she also sends us a picture of a
tree. This is important. The okra was not happy at all with the reduced direct sunlight.
No, the okra needs to be in full sun.
Yeah. So they're shading the tomatoes and beans this year and letting the okra have the full brunt of the sun. Hopefully they'll all be happy. Now I'll say this, okra does get aphids, but it's really easy to wash aphids off of okra. Yeah, they're mostly on the leaves, sometimes on the flowers. Yeah, they do get on the okra itself, but they rinse right off and they don't really do any harm to the plant. So I wouldn't think of any reason for spraying an insecticide on okra. For aphids, you can just literally rinse them off with a good blast of water. And yeah, okra loves full sun and really warm soil. We don't plant okra till almost Memorial Day here in the Sacramento Valley. However, that was the main focus of her picture here.
So this the is other challenging. Picture that she sent was a 4 to 5 year old cherry tree that was burned in that horrible heat wave we had a couple of years back. You can see the resulting damage in the photo below.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you, I'm amazed this thing is still standing. The trunk, and we're looking at from the south side, so we're looking at the damaged side.
Yeah. Yes.
All of the bark is curled up and
flaking off. Yeah.
And underneath it, it's just like hard, solid heartwood. I mean, it's just,
well, it is. That's exactly.
There's nothing growing.
Right. That is,
it's gotta be something on the back side.
Well, if you look closely, if you click on this picture and look closely, you'll see reaction wood, which is already healing this over on both sides of this major burn on the cambium. The entire cambium, which is the water and food conducting tissue of the tree, was destroyed in the major heat wave of September 2022, when we went from 96 degrees on August 31st to 103 degrees on September 1st, and then went into a 10-day epic heat wave. My records from that time indicated we had 2 days at 116 degrees, which that was a record right there for the all-time high temperature, much less the fact that it was in September and we had 2 days in a row. Then we had 2 days at 110 degrees and 3 days at 106 degrees. So 7 days straight over 105 degrees in the month of September 2022. This did significant damage to trees all over the place. And we were just embarking on this large committee evaluating tree species and cultivars for City of Davis, for the City Street Tree Department, and others to use. And that's available, by the way. The output of that committee that met for a good 3 years is available at the City of Davis Urban Forestry website. Seven different lists we came up with, trees for particular situations. We got on a call, a meeting shortly after that heat wave, and started swapping notes about trees that had been damaged. For example, incense cedars in the area were torched. I mean, just we took them off our list because of that kind of damage, because we know that's going to happen again. We know that kind of heat did significant defoliation. This is a native species, not native here, native elsewhere in California, that had been on our list. We all liked incense cedar. Boy, they just got fried. And I'm still looking at pictures at my nursery every so often, someone bringing in a picture. What's this cherry I have, this plum, this peach that's oozing on this damage? It's been damaged on this side of the tree for a while. I said, yeah, it's been damaged since September 2022. It's trying to heal, but it is a point where diseases and pests can get in. Borers in injury like this are very common, and borers will undermine the integrity of the tree. They'll get in there, they'll do structural damage, so the tree can become unsafe. If it's a shade tree, that's a very important factor. A fruit tree, well, not a big deal. If this tree fell down tomorrow, it wouldn't hurt anybody. You can have a cherry tree or a fruit tree with half a cambium. I had a cherry tree for 10 years. It only had half a cambium. It had been through a heat wave. It had gotten burned shortly after I planted it. I just left it. It produced fine. I was perfectly happy with it. And eventually it got to the point where I realized it was more dead than alive, and I took it out. So if your goal is fruit production, this will probably grow and fruit for you, although it will be somewhat stunted by the fact that it's lost half of its cambium. It is trying to heal. At the rate these heal, I would say it'll be 8 or 10 years before that would ever heal back over. And the interior wood would be softened and damaged. So the tree would not have structural integrity. Again, with a fruit tree, we aren't too concerned about that. When I see these kinds of pictures, just as with the peach tree I looked at a few weeks ago, fruit tree lifespan is 20, 25 years, 15 years in the case of a peach tree. So it's getting towards the end in the case of the peach tree I looked at of its actual natural lifespan anyway. This cherry probably has 5 or 6 more years that it could grow and produce for you. But my suggestion would be, if you're growing cherries, 10, 12 feet away, plant a new one. Get it going. It takes about 3 years for them to produce fruiting wood. And so about the time it's beginning to come into production, you may be making a decision about this half a cherry tree that is time for it to go. So, yes, that heat wave did a lot of damage, and it showed us the importance of whitewashing young trees at the time of planting, or at least putting the protective guards on them that most nurseries can provide you when you buy your fruit tree. Whitewashing it now could reduce further damage. We assume it would anyway. You take interior white latex and you mix it 50-50 with water and you paint the trunk. There's not much cambium left there, so I'm not really thinking that whitewashing is going to make a huge difference in the longevity of this tree. But in a younger tree, when you've gotten some injury, we often do recommend whitewashing up to the first branch. This, by the way, is a big advantage of leaving some of the lower branches on your fruit trees when you're making your first decision about training them. So if you have lower branches down there, aside from the fact that it makes it easier to pick the fruit, or in the case of the cherry, easier to protect at least some of the fruit from the spotted winged Drosophila fruit fly, it also shades the trunk. So shading the trunk of your fruit tree should be a goal of every home orchard design, whether by the tree itself or by shrubs nearby or something. So if you do have a trunk that's exposed to direct hot sun, you can get significant sunburn injury.
All right, so we've got some messages. Bob and Katie write, I have two older established pineapple guava bushes that have woody trunks, and at this point seem to be mostly only be producing new growth on top, maybe a little on the outside faces. They are pruned into a short hedge, and there's a picture attached. The inside areas of the bushes near the main branches appear very dead and don't seem to produce new growth. I'm wondering if I can prune these bushes back to the main trunk to encourage new internal growth. And the picture is shows something. I'm guessing that's only like 3 feet tall, it looks like down.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing for a feijoa to be able to keep it that small. So they've done pretty hard pruning on this plant over the years. And this is an issue with any evergreen hedge. Hedges are almost always evergreen in California, is that you're constantly pruning, constantly stimulating new growth, and getting a bunch of new growth to the point that you'll eventually get a density to the upper few inches that shades out everything on the interior of the plant. And over time, it will start to die out on the interior. Some plants, boxwood, privets, yews, I guess they're used more in the East Coast than here, will continue to form growth buds down there. And those growth buds are viable as long as at some point sunlight gets into them. But many woody plants over time, those growth buds that are essentially there dormant either get covered over with bark and essentially fade out, or just wither away. And at some point, you're going to have to either replace the hedge or do something pretty drastic to it. The question here was, is it okay to cut this back real hard? Frequently that works. Feijoa, it'll probably work. So this is one option. Start over. Okay. Assuming that there are growth buds all the way down the trunk to the base, you can literally cut it to a stump and let it resprout. I know you can do this with Pittosporum tabira. I know you can do it with privets. It's not that easy to get rid of privets. And to a degree, you can do it with boxwood because they have a lot of growth buds that are there essentially ready to go. As soon as you clear away all the stuff that's shading them and also all that hormone effect that's suppressing the growth of those buds. So you've
And
suddenly.
xylosma. Don't forget xylosma.
Xylosma is another, yeah, widely used here. So these are big plants that are being kept small. Photinia is another good example, probably the best known example locally because they're flushing all their bright red new growth. That's Photinia fraseri. These are popular hedge plants, broadleaf evergreens here on the West Coast. Now, I know back east they use viburnums and they use taxus and certain other plants. You need to know your plant because if you cut a juniper back that way,
Oops, I
congratulations.
did.
Yeah, that's right. You've removed your juniper. And that's very handy, actually. You can just dig it out or move over a couple of feet and plant a new one. But if you do it with something like a privet, you know full well if you've tried to get rid of a privet that way, it doesn't get rid of the privet. So, what I suggest, if possible, is to take some narrow pruners. And you can find these at cannabis shops, actually, hydro shops. They're designed for that purpose. Grapevine pruners also are narrow needle nose type pruners. And just spend some time, not a whole lot of time all at once, but do this over a period of time, thinning out the top somewhat, taking out chunks of the top to get more sunlight in there. And if you do that, you'll probably get some buds further down on the plant to break and grow. And you can cut a little higher than you would if you went to the severe approach that I was mentioning earlier. So you can get some new interior growth if you haven't gone too far. Many years ago, I consulted on a 100-year-old boxwood hedge in the downtown Sacramento area. If you all know where a land park is, it was in Land Park. And this hedge had been clipped for it appeared to be about 100 years, kept it about 3x3. And they were just coming along and shearing it, as maintenance gardeners often will do, pretty much every time they came through. So the poor plant one never really got a chance to grow all that much. It would put on 2 to 3 inches of growth and be sheared again. And it was beginning to get so bare on the interior that you could grasp a chunk of the hedge and pull it towards you. And it was essentially completely open on the inside. And regrettably, the carbohydrate balance of that hedge was beginning to fail. And what was happening was that a small number of them, one here, one there, were beginning to die out. And they were very concerned because this was a historic cottage and a historic hedge. I said, well, this doesn't require a lot of work all at once. It just requires a lot of work over time. Get in there and thin it out gradually to try and get some more growth on the interior before you lose these plants. Because if you do lose them, matching them is going to be a little bit challenging. And there'd be a period when it looks a little funky. So my suggestion, and they did this, was get in there and just start thinning out the top to get a little more sunlight to the interior. You can do that. You can also, if the plant hasn't gone too far, as the question came up here, cut it back very hard. But it is a good idea to prune your hedges in a way that you can rejuvenate them every so often. So the constant shearing is not great. I would prefer to see hedges managed, even when you want a more formal look, with a once or twice a year pruning where you're taking hand clippers and going in and cutting out individual shoots that have gotten too high. If we had a camera on here, you'd see me doing all kinds of hand gestures. Lois can see it. How we're going to do this, getting in there with hand pruners and thinning them out a little bit rather than the constant shearing. Constant shearing 20, 30 years, you can keep that up. At some point, it just starts to die out and you have a problem on your hands. This has been a while. It looks like it's been 15 or 20 years of clipping it this way. So if it were me, I would just make several strategic cuts on the top of this to get some more sunlight on the interior. If you prefer and don't mind several months of it looking kind of odd, cutting it back real hard in the case of this species will probably work real well.
So this is spring, it's the 1st of April, and this plant is probably putting out new growth now or soon. So would this be the best time of year to do your opening it up a little bit?
Yeah, March and October, and it's April 1. April is fine as long as we're not suddenly spiking into super high temperatures. And even that isn't necessarily a big concern. I remember pruning a hedge for someone once when we had a landscape crew, and we were doing it in June, and then we had a heat wave right as we finished, and the exposed leaves sunburned. And so I had to go out and apologize to the homeowner basically and say, look, I promise you, this will actually outgrow this. Trust me. And it did, thank goodness. But because it was just a cosmetic thing, but it was very sudden. I had exposed a bunch of interior leaves that had developed in more shade. Therefore, they were thinner. They had less of a waxy coating. Suddenly, they were in the sun. Suddenly, we had a heat wave. So they all scorched. It did outgrow it. I mean, yes, it was not a very professional thing for us to do. I probably should have used better judgment. That's what I said. But in general, we do
You
that.
don't do that work anymore.
That's correct. We don't do
You
that kind of.
stopped. It's not worth it.
Yeah, we don't do that kind of work. So March, April, or October, early November is usually optimal for this kind of thing, and it's a good time to go out and do some prune here, prune there. My goal, and I would tell the staff this back when we did that kind of landscape work, it's best if we get done and it doesn't look like we've pruned it. It just is the size we want. So you've done a neat enough pruning job that you're taking strategic branches out, cutting them to a well-chosen location rather than just taking head shears and cutting across the top. I realize there may be professional gardeners listening. Hi, Eric, out there who have to prune with head shears and have to do it fairly constantly because that's what the customers expect. I've gotten in the middle of this as a consultant with between like Homeowners Association Landscape Committee and the landscape crew where I'm saying they shouldn't be pruning this often, but they probably think you want them to. So you all have to come to a meeting of the minds about better management of the plants versus the custodial look, as I call it, that you're after. Clip this plant so it never looks different. Plants are not accessories, okay? They're living organisms. Follow their actual natural life cycle. Right now, they're flushing on new growth. Why would you shear off Photinia fraseri when the red new growth is one of the things we grow it for? Why not let that grow out, get past fire blight season? There's a separate conversation right there, and then prune it back in June as after the main flush of spring growth has happened. Get in there and just individually cut branches back a couple feet rather than shearing it across the top. Shearing off the new growth of a plant where that's an actual feature strikes me as a strange thing to do. But again, as the landscaper will tell you, they think you want that. So you should probably have a meeting with your maintenance gardener, whether we're talking about an HOA or a homeowner, or that maintenance gardener is your spouse. It's time to give the plant the proper pruning, not the constant shearing. End rant.
Post rant,
Ahead.
I want to say that if you do want to have a hedge, you can avoid a number of these problems simply by structuring the shape of the hedge. In other words,
Yes.
if the hedge is slightly wider at the bottom than at the top, then sunlight can get in from the sides.
Yes.
If it's absolutely vertical, you're doing a lot of shading. If it's the other way, it's narrower at the bottom and wider at the top, then you've totally shaded out the side plant. So that's one thing.
Yeah.
And the other is that if you can just determine that you want a range of height, at sometimes you want it to be 3 feet, and at other times you want it if 4 feet is okay, then you can let the top grow for a while. And when you cut it back, you're not cutting it back always to the same point.
Yeah, that's another point.
And
Yes. Yep.
yeah, and if you have a huge hedge like I do out my back, but oh, I love that look. It's xylosma. And if I were to have someone go and cut it off at 12 feet every year,
Yeah.
it would be like those lollipop trees. You'd get all of these buds breaking at the same point, and it wasn't structurally strong. But if I say, okay, 12 feet, now next year cut it down to 11 and a half feet, you've cut off that wood that's all that crumply stuff, and it's starting over again. So plan your hedge and plan how the plant will be healthiest.
I would say the other thing would be choose your plants better.
Oh yeah. Oh
Okay,
yeah.
so putting photinias under a window makes no sense to me. If you like that look, just put Raphiolepis under the window. I mean, there's a zillion other choices, but there are shrubs that only get 3 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet, feet, and so forth. I have a hedge we did here, actually, of boxwood, the most common hedge plant, Buxus microphylla japonica green beauty. If someone walks in, they want a hedge, that's probably what I'm going to sell them. It grows almost anywhere. Folks back east are having disease problems on it, but in the west, it's still one of our most adaptable, reliable hedge plants. It grows about a foot a year. Most people don't know that this can make a very attractive 6 to 7 foot informal natural hedge. We planted this along a walk where we just wanted to screen off the driveway, and it's 10 years in, and I have not pruned it at all. I pinched them the first year a little bit, and that's it. And they're 7 feet tall. I put them 3 feet apart, so it's close enough that it makes a solid hedge, and it's very attractive that way. It doesn't look pruned. It doesn't look clipped and sheared and geometric. Plants are not geometric in nature typically. So I would
And I bet the
suggest.
birds love it, don't they?
Yeah, and it's in an area nearby, some more informal plants. And so I decided just leave it that way. It has iceberg roses nearby that I'm allowing to grow more naturally, for example. And they provide a pretty good hedge just by themselves. So choosing your plant carefully so you're not making a lot of work for yourself or your maintenance gardening crew is probably a better way to go in the long run. And the other problem we have is that certain plants become very popular for hedges. I'm glad to see this was a question about feijoa, which is not as commonly used, sometimes called pineapple guava, because it's a great choice for a big hedge. We tend to, in the industry and landscapers and designers, oh, they want a hedge, give them boxwood. They want a hedge, give them pittosporum. And we tend to overuse certain things. If any plant has been overused in this category, it's Photinia fraseri, has been used, planted by the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, around California and other Western states. Came on the market in the 60s, just became insanely popular right from the start, and good reason, but it's been planted so heavily that, as expected, we've now have some disease and pest problems on it. You can get lace bug on it, you can get fire blight on it. Both of those are very challenging to manage. And regrettably, lace bug is something it shares with its closely related native friend, Toyon. So if you happen to have Photinia and you happen to have Toyon, you get lace bug on the one, you're going to get lace bug on both of them. I like Photinia in its place. I like it unpruned as a 15-foot shrub, which is what it does. Photinia fraseri gets 10 to 15 feet, but it's almost never allowed to do that. And hard pruning makes it more vulnerable to fire blight. Hard pruning weakens plants over time. So instead of putting in a 15-foot shrub where you need a 6-foot hedge, I'd suggest putting in a 6 or 7-foot shrub where you need a 6-foot hedge. Viburnum tinus, something like that. There are other options. And within the native category, by the way, Toyon is one of the best if you need a big hedge plant. It's big. They get 10, 15 feet with no problem, but they are prunable. And Toyon, even though it's not technically native to our plant community in this area, is proving to be very widely adaptable all over California. Birds love the berries, the flowers attract beneficials, and it does take to careful pruning. Let's not prune it like a hedge. Let's let it grow more naturally.
Wow, we had a lot of depressing topics. Let's try another one.
Okay.
So Kenneth writes, "Oh well, this isn't that a happy either. I'm not seeing the labels VFNT much on the tomato plants anymore. I understand that early girls are usually this, but they're not labeled that way. Do I assume that they are disease resistant? How can you tell?"
Well, that's interesting. Yes, there's some new disease packages, as they call them, being bred into tomato varieties. And if you go to sites like Johnny's Selected Seed, Burpee Seed, the seed catalog companies will give you that information. They won't give you the full information because it's getting kind of complicated. Verticillium wilt resistance is pretty standard. That you see the V on there, that tells you yes, it's probably resistant to verticillium wilt. Fusarium wilt, we're up to three strains. Most of the tomato varieties you buy are resistant to strain one, maybe strain two, not necessarily strain three. Nematode tolerance is a very complicated subject, and it is correct. I've noticed that the N seems to be disappearing from labels. Part of it is that nematode tolerance is a better term than nematode resistant. Second is that nematode tolerance is variable on site conditions. If you have a nematode problem, planting VFN, N being the operative part, would be an important part of your management strategy for nematodes. But it's important to know that it doesn't kill them. You're not reducing the population by planting them. They're simply tolerant to the presence of root knot nematodes. You probably have other plants nearby that are hosts for root knot nematodes. So you're your problem is going to keep getting worse, more or less. More to the point, a lot of the breeding now that you're seeing is with respect to leaf diseases. So people back east where it rains in the summer are dealing with early blight, late blight, septoria leaf spot, things like that that attack the foliage or the stem and cause dieback. What I have done when I'm trying to find out more information, as you are, is I try to go and find the breeder's site themselves rather than necessarily seed catalogs, which are trying to sell you something, but go to Ball Seed Company or some of the other big breeders and see if you can get information there. And oftentimes you'll get very detailed information about which diseases and which pests you're dealing with. And each one requires a kind of a different strategy. That's why the 3-year rotation rule we give you is a guideline. It's a rule of thumb. It's variably effective with respect to verticillium versus fusarium versus nematodes. And it's a challenging topic. It is, however, still a good idea not to keep planting members of the nightshade family in the same place year after year after year, even if they're supposedly tolerant to nematodes, because you're not reducing your problem. Nematodes are a complicated conversation. There is, for those of you who are dealing with it, a product called Nematode Control. Saponin-based material. It's organic, but it's toxic. Read the label carefully. You drench the plant with it. You do that a couple of times, and I'm getting very good feedback on that from people who have dealt with root knot nematode. It's something that nurseries are having trouble getting, but you can buy it online from various places that sell, believe it or not, pesticides online. So Nematode Control, easy to remember, Monterey brand, and that is something you can use to drench plants if you're really dealing with a nematode problem. But I do urge you not to get complacent just because you have a label that suggests it'll be resistant. And don't keep planting in the same spot year after year if you possibly can avoid that. Whenever I say that, I do want to throw in, I know you don't all have giant yards. Okay. Not everybody has 3 separate beds that they can carefully rotate in order to avoid root and soil diseases. So do the best you can. How's that? And just be aware that some plants are going to be more vulnerable than others. You are correct. The labels are getting more confusing. Part of it, one grower told me this. He has to buy 1,000 to 10,000 of any label he's buying. So if he's got early girl, early girl bush, early girl plus, he's just going to buy an early girl label. Okay. He's not going to buy separate labels for all 3 of them. He actually has his staff sometimes right on there, plus or bush by hand, because it's easier than buying labels for everything. So part of it is the labeling issue, but you can get more information typically from the breeder sites.
Well, here's our saying for this week. This is from Augustus Jenkins Farmer. I don't know if that farmer is the surname or is the descriptor, but gardens are the story of two things, culture and biology. Gardeners are the storytellers.
That's charming. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.